This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The band Metallica, the biggest-selling rock act of the 90s, has survived for over 25 years. My guest is singer and guitarist James Hetfield, one of the founders of the band. As the Rolling Stone Encyclopedia of Rock and Roll says, after gaining a solid cult following among fans who could not identify with contemporary pretty boy pop metal combos such as Van Halen and Bon Jovi, Metallica became known for its sophisticated, often complex song structure and serious lyrics that reflected teen obsession with anger, despair, fear, and death. I spoke with Hetfield in 2004, the year that the documentary about the band was released on DVD. That film, Some Kind of Monster, chronicled the making of their album Saint Anger, and the anger, tension, and exhaustion that nearly broke up the band as the members neared middle age. The band actually hired a therapist to do group therapy sessions. During this period, Hetfield checked himself into rehab. When he emerged, Metallica completed Saint Anger. Here's a song from it called Some Kind of Monster. These are the legs in circles run. This is the beating you'll never know. These are the lips that taste no freedom. This is the feel that's not so safe. This is the face you'll never change. This is the God that ain't so pure. This is the God that is not pure. This is the voice of silence. James Hetfield, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's start at the beginning of Metallica's history. What did you want Metallica to be?
Oh, boy. I wanted it to be freedom from school, from work, from the typical music that we were hearing. But really, it was music was somewhat of an escape for me that turned into a really great gift eventually. But it was a way to get away from my screwed up family.
What was screwed up about your family?
No one really communicated very well. It was very insular, very somewhat elitist in our religion. That's what they believe, but we believe this, which is better. You know, which is Christian Science. I grew up in that type of atmosphere. And I never really understood it either. So I felt very alienated from the outside world and from my family. So it was a connection, music for me was. But Metallica, when we hooked up, we were just passionate and loved music. And it was the soundtrack for our lives, you know, that it spoke for us.
And how old were you when the band started?
Let's see. Fresh out of high school, so 18 or 19, we started.
So no college?
No. We had college on the road, basically. Street college.
So you said that music was also an escape from work. Was this an escape from the work that you would have been doing had you not been in a band, or were you already working?
Well, I was working, and my dad left a note saying he was leaving at age 13. Never really said goodbye. My mom passed away at 16. I went and lived with my older brother, and she left some inheritance for me, but it was really, it was so tough to even want to touch that. It was like that was still mom. I didn't want to mess with that. So I went and I got a job working at a high school, moving a high school. Then it was custodial work. Then I went working in a factory because I had the long hair. That was pretty much all I could get. And, oh, it was so frustrating just sitting there. It was okay. I at lunch would go out and write in my truck, mm-hmm. write some songs. But I remember seeing this older guy working as the foreman. Hey, one day you'll be foreman. Ooh, joy. Yeah. You know, and he's, I don't know, 40, 50 years old. And it's like, man, I cannot do this. I have to play music. That was in me. I knew it had to happen.
No, I don't think you ever got into the kind of Spinal Tap type of show busy, you know, heavy metal stuff with the breastplates and the cod pieces and right. I mean, you never were into that, right?
Well, under my jeans.
Under your jeans, yes.
Well, we did some tours.
You're
with
more
bands.
Like t-shirts and jeans.
Basically.
Yeah.
Yeah, we would walk on stage and play with what was comfortable. You know, wearing a spiked wristband with. You know, with nails sticking out of it, didn't you know? You really couldn't wipe your forehead off with that. You know, it wasn't comfortable. You know, at the end of the day, we wanted to be, you know, just us. And you know, we had done some tours with bands. And growing up in LA, it was kind of everywhere. And that was a little bit tried to sneak in. You know, I had bullet belts. You know, because Lemmy from Motorhead had that. That was the extent of our dressing up. You know, but.
Did you have your destructive period of destroying hotel rooms and?
Oh yeah, oh definitely. A lot of our early lyrics were all about that, you know, on the road, show up in a city, rape, pillage, move on, you know.
No, what's your explanation for why you wanted to do that?
Oh, because I guess we could, because I guess we were angry, we needed attention, and partly because you were supposed to, you know. We'd heard about, you know, the decadence of the 70s bands, you know, going in and they had orgies, they had, you know, they were throwing TVs out of, you know, you heard all those stories and we didn't really throw any TVs out of windows, but we jumped out of windows into pools, breaking bones, you know, setting off hotel alarms and at 4 a.m. and having to pay for everyone's room, you know, things like that, you know, kicking holes in walls, whatever, all kinds of just, you know, kind of releases. And after a while, it became a trap. You know, you're on tour paying for your destruction, you know, and you're not bringing any money home. So
did you enjoy it? Did you enjoy destroying things?
There was something about it. And it tied in with my anger a lot. And I had a lot of anger and rage problems that would just overcome me. And I would... Whatever was near, I'd throw it, and it would break. And it was just this adolescence that stuck with me, you know. And, you know, when I finally started, dating my wife-to-be, who is my wife now, Francesca, she, you know, it was embarrassing. It was embarrassing to myself and to her. And she helped me grow up quite a bit. But, yeah, there was something about smashing stuff that just felt right. It felt good.
Do you think that anger worked for you musically?
Oh, completely.
Yeah.
I do now.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, we didn't analyze anything. It was just going for, it was going with the heart is what we called it, you know. It was whatever was coming out at the time. You know, I can't change what has happened, you know. Everything that has happened in our career, you know, as far as angry lyrics or whatever it was coming out subliminally even, that happened for a reason. It all happened for a reason for us to get where we are now, to realize, wow, that we were very, very immature in a way, but writing about it, you know, not knowing how to grow up or how to change your survival techniques or your tools in life, how to relate to people. And, you know, it took the band almost breaking up to realize a lot of things. And one was our form of expression and what a gift we have in that. And, you know, after getting clean and sober, going back and reading a lot of the lyrics, going, wow, that's pretty intense. And I can't believe there's some fans out there that really like this, you know.
Give me an example of what you're thinking.
Oh, well, something like A Dyer's Eve. This is a song about my parents and how they kept me in a cocoon, you know, not allowing me to see the world or what different religions there were or different kinds of people or, you know, for me, learning about other things was not, they were trying to keep me in a, almost like a cult type mm-hmm. of religion. Mm-hmm. It felt like to me. And this song talks about, you know, now that you're gone, I'm out here in the world and lost and I'm scared and, you know, I blame you completely. And a lot of blame put onto my parents, you know, at that point. And it's pretty heavy stuff when I read it now. And, you know, but I realized my parents were doing the best they could with what they had to work with, you know. I didn't realize the trickle-down effect from their parents, you know. You know, you look at your parents as they're gods in a way, you know. They could never do wrong, you know. And but looking back and realizing that, yeah, they made some mistakes, but they did the best they could. And let me sort out those mistakes and try and not repeat them.
Well, why don't we hear that song? This is Metallica.
Dear mother, dear father, what is this?
So, okay, so that song speaks a bit about your parents. You know, your mother's dad, your father's still alive?
No, he's passed away. He passed away about 12 years ago or so.
Did you write this before he died? Or?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
What did he think when he heard it?
I don't know, and I really didn't care. Uh-huh. We didn't connect again for a long time.
Right.
And it was somewhat difficult. Trying to figure out what is this relationship? What is it? Am I supposed to hate him still? You know, he's my dad. I love him, but dude, I mean, you screwed us over. You left, took all our money, enough that my mom couldn't survive, and she worried herself sick and eventually died, and kind of was left hanging. And a lot of the stuff I was mad about was really, him not teaching me how to be a man or a boy or whatever it was. And I had to figure it all out by myself, I felt, you know. And I wasn't ready for it. But I worked a lot of that anger out and some therapy things, which was really helpful. But, yeah, you know, our relationship was very strange. After he left, it devastated me, you know. Well, he came back probably 6 months or to a year later, and he was... You know, he was midlife crisis dad, you know, had the stingray and the funky haircut. He shaved and who's this guy, you know, bringing me gifts from Europe, you know, and Hawaii. And meanwhile, we're struggling, you know.
Right.
So we had a strange relationship. Eventually got to be somewhat friends again. But it was never resolved. The stuff wasn't never resolved.
My guest is James Hetfield of Metallica. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with James Hetfield, Metallica's lead singer and guitarist. Our interview was recorded in 2004 after the DVD release of the documentary Some Kind of Monster. It chronicled a difficult period in the band's life. Everyone was so angry with each other, the band hired a therapist who usually worked with sports teams to help them figure out what to do. In this scene from the documentary, the band is listening back to one of their rehearsal tapes. Hetfield doesn't like what the drummer Lars Ulrich is playing. Ulrich isn't very enthusiastic about the guitar playing. It hasn't been a good day.
Just real confusing sound.
It's just jacking the vocals all up. I mean, it's clever and everything, but... I don't see what it does to it.
I think that's how you hear it, dude. I mean, that's fine. I'm just trying to do something different.
I mean, I'm used to having the drummer do the beat part. You know what I mean? Holding it together.
What I'm hearing is... Let me choose my words carefully here. It's pretty straightforward, and the guitar shit, it's a little stock. So I started trying to introduce some kind of edge to it on the drums.
Those things we throw out to each other are complete bullshit, you know? It sounds too stock, it sounds too normal to me. I mean, You know what I mean? You're saying this shit so you can get your point across about doing a drum beat. I mean, you know, it doesn't hold any water.
To you.
It doesn't.
I think it's f***ing stock. What? Which part of that is unclear to you? I think it sounds stock to my ears. I mean, you want me to write it down? I think it feels stock,
I
okay?
Can't hear you.
So I...
When you say, you're telling me what to play right now. You're telling me you should play with what Kirk's doing, and I'm telling you it's stock.
Dude, fine.
You know what, guys? Why don't we just go in there and just hammer it out, all right, instead of hammering on each other?
This is so silly. You're just sitting there going, I'm in a really pissy mood, and you're just sitting here being a complete
You're really helping matters. You're really good at that. I was straight up with you, and I told you I'm in a shit mood, and what have you been doing? Picking at me all night.
Come on, guys. We got better things to do. Right?
Yeah, I do. I do.
So this moment in the documentary, you're really angry, you walk out, and then you're going to rehab and you don't come back for 11 months later. When you walked out of the room, did you know that you were headed to rehab after that?
Yeah. Yeah. It's somewhat deceiving in the movie that, you know, I slammed that door. You know, Bob came out and we had a talk. You know, eventually I came back another time and I talked about how things weren't going well at home, how I'd got thrown out of the house. And a lot of that revolved around that and how things in the band weren't going well or at home. And just, wow, how lost I felt. My whole world was shaking under me, you know, all of the roots, the foundations that I felt I had in my life. And I came back and I talked to them that, hey, I've you know, after so-and-so date, I have to go away. I have to work on myself.
Right.
And they knew. I couldn't just leave, you know, that was not right, but it was discussed. Mm-hmm. And I told mm-hmm. them, you know, I don't know how long it's going to be, and I don't know, you're gonna have to trust me on this. I just know I have to go and just, you know, I have to rebuild my life. I have to strip down. I had no idea what was in store for me, really, but I knew I had to get some help.
Were you like a star in the rehab unit?
That was the hugest fear out of everything.
What, that you'd be or that you'd not be?
That I would be.
Mm-hmm.
That, it's so silly now to think about it. But at that time, you know, for me, the biggest fear was, you know, I had tried therapy before and to stop drinking and my just destructive behaviors. I wasn't really ready for it. And I thought, well, that doesn't really work for me. And then my wife says, you got to check yourself in somewhere. You got to go to a hospital or a rehab or something. It's like, no way. Don't you know who I am, kind of thing? You know, I wouldn't get real treatment there. You know, I couldn't do that. And my fear was that I couldn't. There was no help for me. And I was, of course, creating that fear for myself to continue my behavior, you know. But when I went there, I checked in under a different name, did all that stuff, you know, had the tag on that said, hi, my name is Frank, blah, blah, whatever it was. And, at the first meeting they had in there, people went around the room saying their names and what, you know, was going on in their lives. And I just said, you know what? My name's James and I got a fake tag on and this is crap and I'm here to get some help and I'm fearful of this and this and this. And I broke down crying and I told people my fears and man, they were just right behind me saying, don't worry about it. You know, you're human. We're all humans in here struggling. And that right then I knew I was in the right place.
My guest is James Hetfield of Metallica. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with James Hetfield, Metallica's lead singer and guitarist. It was recorded in 2004 after the DVD release of the documentary Some Kind of Monster, which chronicled the period when Metallica hired a therapist to work out problems in the band. Whose idea in the band was it to actually hire a therapist and have the band work through its issues like a couple might go to a marriage counselor?
It pretty much is a marriage counselor. Mr. Toll, he was a therapist. He didn't have a therapist license. He was an enhancement coach, which was, you know, another form of, attitude adjustment, but basically that told us that he could give feedback, and eventually it was tough to kind of find the boundary of friend and, whatever, hired coach. Mm-hmm. But he came on board when our management Q Prime called and said, "What do you think about this? He's worked with another one of our acts, and we got to get talking, because that was the big deal. There was no communication, over the years of this machine of Metallica rolling on. We discovered that, say, a band like a Guns N' Roses, they're in each other's face. They're very vocal about their attitudes, their thinking, their feelings. We said, we can't do that. Look at them. And they eventually break up. So we're not going to do that. So we shut up for years and years and years. And that was self-destructive as well. We had to communicate. So we got this guy, Phil Toll, to come in. He was like a mediator in a way. He kind of made the room safe, neutralized the room. So helped us talk to each other, because there was a lot of diffusing of bombs in the early days. So much baggage, tons, heavy stuff from years and years, a resentment that had just crushed our creativity and our friendships.
Was there something that the therapist actually helped you understand about the relationship of the members of the band that you don't think would have emerged without him?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, when he brought up the word ego, I looked at Lars. He looked at me, and then we had to look at each other, ourselves, Right. We had to look in the mirror. Like, okay, yeah, all right. I'll own a little bit of that. And eventually it's like, yeah, you know what? We've both driven each other to certain just egotistical giants, And thank God Kirk, was such the referee through life, And Jason obviously didn't fit in because he was like the minor ego, and it was out of balance, it seemed like. But yeah, that was a shock somewhat. And yeah, I brought up the words, ogre or intimidator, and how I hated being that person. I want to have friends. Why don't I have friends? And they're telling me, well, you're like this. It's like, well, no, I'm not. I don't want to be that. How do I not be that? And that's when I realized that was a tool I brought with me since childhood, intimidate. Man, my dad was pretty darn good at that. He'd just shoot a look and that was all. That's all you needed to know. And that, it was such a great tool to not have to get to know people, I didn't have to get friendly with anyone. Intimacy was so scary. And it still is, it gets so close to someone. What if they leave? I would be crushed, It's like the amount of love that you give to me equated the amount of hurt when they left, right. And it's still, I still struggle with that.
You know what I find interesting? Like the kind of fan who relates to like the persona that you created, like the mythic version of yourself, the onstage version of yourself, and they're trying to model themselves on somebody who you're not even. Do you know funny. What I mean? It's like, this is something like you created. It works really well on stage, but it's not what you are off stage. And they're trying to be that onstage person.
Yeah, it is. It is quite a strange cycle. And, for me, there are parts of me on the stage that are certainly me. There's somewhat of a hat or jacket that you put on and perform. We're performers.
Yeah, yeah.
But with a real heart. And, it's all really about the music. But when fans come to see you play, they want to see something. They you can't just stand there and play. You could, but it's not as entertaining as running around or showing on your face some of the anger of a song or some of the sadness on a song or some of the thing. It is performing. And then when they meet you at the airport, you're waiting for your bags and, they come up to you, "Hi, how's it going?" And you're, kind of tired from a flight and you're shaking hands and they're like, "Wow, you're not what I thought you were." And instantly, it's like, why do I feel depressed about that, So you think I should jump on the turnwheel and like smash some bags, or what should I do, you know? And I'm not going to do that, you know. It's, you know, yeah, this is me, and maybe I'm in a crabby mood, so go away, or, you know, whatever it may be, or, hey, I'm in a great mood, come over here, let's take a picture. And, you know, it's subjective to moods at times, and but when people get disappointed for meeting you, that's so strange. And but I've owned what part is mine and what is theirs, because, you know, they've got something built up in their head that they need for their life.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's not that they meet, they're disappointed in what they've built up for themselves. And sometimes that's a tough reality check. And, you know, so I leave that with them. But I also am nice and say, hey, you know, this is another part of me.
James Hetfield, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
James Hetfield is Metallica's lead singer and guitarist.